This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. The Fall of the House of Dixie is the new book by our first guest, Bruce Levine. It's about how the Civil War ended the institution of slavery, destroyed the world of the slaveholding elite, and transformed the South as well as American politics. About one out of every three people in the South suddenly emerged from bondage to freedom, he writes. A change of such magnitude and rife with so many implications as to almost defy description. The book is also the story of how Abraham Lincoln changed during the course of the war. He went to war to compel the slave states to return to the Union and promised not to interfere with slavery in the seceding states. But as the war dragged on, he decided to weaken the South by stripping it of its slave labor. Levine is the J.G. Randall Distinguished Professor of History at the University of Illinois. He spoke with Terry last Tuesday.
Bruce Levine, welcome to Fresh Air. So let me just start by asking you what you thought of the movie Lincoln.
I had very mixed feelings about the film. On the one hand, it's a Civil War movie that very properly places slavery and the Republican parties and Abraham Lincoln's determination to see slavery die at the center of the story, and that makes this an unusual Civil War film and a valuable Civil War film. And there are many things about the film that are very good and very strong and very commendable. But on the other hand, I think it gives too little context about the story in which this tale actually unfolds. It leaves out key facts that explain the meaning of what we're seeing on the screen and how it is that these events took place, the prior course of the war, the important role, especially that slaves and free blacks played in advancing the Union cause, the important role that they played in already breaking down slavery significantly, long before the question of a 13th Amendment arose, and the growth of anti-slavery sentiment in the Union. And finally, who initiated the idea of a 13th Amendment, which wasn't Abraham Lincoln?
Who was it?
It was free blacks and the radical wing of the Republican Party, captured in the film by Tommy Lee Jones playing Thaddeus Stevens. These were the folks who in 1863 and abolitionists began to push very hard for amending the Constitution. And Lincoln was not on board until the summer of 1864.
Well, you point out that when the Civil War started, President Lincoln had no intention of freeing the slaves. What did he want?
Lincoln wanted to bring the seceded states back into the Union as quickly and as peacefully as possible, because he and his party had a plan to eventually, gradually, peacefully do away with slavery by legislative means. It was that intention, of course, that had led slave states to begin to secede, but neither Lincoln nor his party saw the resulting war as the instrument of abolition. So what they hoped to do is find a way quickly to bring those states back in and then get on with the business of peacefully, gradually setting the stage for slavery's eventual extinction.
So you're saying that Lincoln wanted to bring the states that had seceded back into the Union and then slowly back legislation that would end slavery.
Exactly.
Lincoln's view of slavery evolved. What did he believe when he took office?
Well, Lincoln said he had believed since childhood, and I see no reason to doubt him, that this was an immoral institution as well as a politically backward and economically stunting institution, so that on all fronts it was objectionable. Lincoln believed, however, that previous constitutional provisions limited what either the people like him, people who oppose slavery, and the federal government as a whole could do about eliminating slavery within the states where it already existed. They all, however, believed that slavery was a system that needed to expand in order to survive, the way they say a shark needs to keep moving in order to breathe. So Lincoln and his party concluded in the mid-1850s that the way to eventually kill slavery constitutionally was to prevent it from spreading any further. And so his party placed at the center of its platform the pledge to outlaw slavery in all the then extensive federal territories.
And, of course, the South didn't like that.
No, they certainly did not like that. The South agreed that this was a system that needed to expand, and so they saw the handwriting on the wall. They also assumed that the accession of a Republican president would pose all sorts of other dangers in addition to their system, that Republicans would start appearing in the South, that Lincoln would make appointments of Republicans to customs houses and post offices, that those would form the nuclei of Republican parties within the slave states, that those parties would then begin to attract disaffected white supporters, that their electoral campaigns would encourage slaves to rebel. And so they greeted the appearance of the Republican Party, much less Lincoln's eventual election to the presidency, as a mortal threat. Most of them did, in any case.
Getting back to what Lincoln believed about slavery, there was a period when he thought that slavery should end, but the slaves should leave after they were freed because there was no way that America would work with slaves freed and then trying to be equal in the United States. What did he think was not going to work about that? What were his doubts?
Well, Lincoln believed that whites would not tolerate the existence of free blacks in such substantial numbers in their midst. That was his fundamental, at least that was the view that he specifically articulated, that these people, moreover, were too different. Lincoln did not look upon Africans as legitimate members at that point of American society. He sympathized with them. He was sorry that they had been dragged here and their ancestors had been dragged here from Africa. He sympathized with their plight, but he did not believe the country could exist with substantial numbers of free blacks, whether citizens and equal or not, alongside whites. And so he, until the middle of the war, kept attempting to convince free blacks and newly freed blacks to voluntarily emigrate.
To where?
Well, there were various ideas about where to do that, in parts of Central America, perhaps South America, the Caribbean, perhaps Africa. There was, as you probably know, already a state in Africa, Liberia, created earlier in the century by emancipated blacks, and that was another possible site.
So what changed Lincoln's mind and led him to issue the Emancipation Proclamation in 1863?
Well, his fundamental plan about what to do about slavery changed in the same way that those of the rest of his party changed, and that was the discovery that bringing the slave states back into the Union was not going to be nearly as easy nor nearly as quick a proposition as they had initially hoped. The white South was much too united in support of the Confederacy, and they were far more effective militarily than, again, Lincoln and others had apparently anticipated. So by the middle of 1862, it has become clear to Lincoln that this essential source of support to the Confederacy, and that's what the 4 million slaves were. They had been the chief labor force in peacetime. They were now an important source of military strength to the Confederacy in wartime in all sorts of ways, though not as soldiers, as some people have claimed, that this source of Confederate strength had to be removed and, in fact, turned to the service of the Union. And emancipation was the way to do that. Lincoln, it should be said, though, didn't pioneer that idea. Republicans in Congress had begun doing that in the first year of the war.
So you were saying that President Lincoln didn't issue the Emancipation Proclamation until he was convinced that that was really going to help the war effort. Did it?
It certainly did. And we have much testimony to that effect. By the end of the Civil War, nearly 200,000 black men had served in either the Union Army or the Union Navy. And that alone was an enormous military assistance to the Union at a time when volunteering had fallen drastically and when there was a great deal of hostility to the draft. So these 200,000 men significantly contributed to giving the Union armies the volume, the bulk, the size that they needed to cope with their Confederate opponents, and that gave the Union the power ultimately to overwhelm the opposition.
And were these African-American men from the North or the South or both?
About 80% of them were from the South. Now, yes, of course, that leaves 20% from the North. And the well-known film Glory is about a unit primarily composed, in fact, the 54th Massachusetts, of Northern free blacks. But 80% of Union black soldiers had been slaves very shortly before being inducted into the war. So they're almost literally going straight from the fields into uniform.
You write, one of the paradoxes of the Civil War is that the war actually ended slavery sooner than it would have ended had the Confederate States stayed in the Union.
Absolutely. There was a general assumption, North and South, that slavery would survive for a very long time in 1860. There was that opinion. And absent a war, it very likely would have lasted, I think, another half century or more. So there might very well have been slavery still in the 20th century. Even the propositions that were on the table in most cases for the peaceful, gradual end of slavery would still have maintained some people in slavery, again, into the 20th century. So that in taking what they assumed to be a defensive position in support of slavery, the leaders of the Confederacy radically hastened its eradication.
So what was it about the war that hastened the end of slavery?
Well, it's a number of factors. One is what Lincoln calls the friction and abrasion of war. Wherever Union armies went, slaves took the opportunity to escape to their lines. Wherever Union armies approached, that is to say, didn't quite reach a given plantation, but slaves there heard that they were at least within running distance, slaves could use that fact to embolden themselves to resist the orders of their owners and even to begin stating conditions under which they would continue to labor on those plantations. And so Confederate plantation owners in those circumstances, whether they wished to or not, often found themselves having for the first time openly to bargain with people whom in law they legally controlled. Something else that's happening is that large numbers of Northern whites who may previously have had no sympathy for blacks are, by virtue of moving into ever more deeply the land of slavery, are being confronted with the brutalities of slavery and being confronted with the fact that much pro-slavery propaganda that they have been hearing for decades by Northern allies of the slave owners are lies, and that this system is pretty horrible. And many of them start writing in letters home to their relatives that, contrary to their original assumptions, they have now become, in effect, abolitionists, and they will never tolerate slavery again.
So I'm going to ask a really stupid question that probably anybody who ever took an American history course, as I have, should not need to ask. But tell me more about why it was so important to the North to maintain the Union. If the South was doing something that the North was so horrified at, the institution of slavery, and the South wanted to pull away, but there was still a lot of racism in the North. Why did the North care so much about having the Southern states within the Union?
Well, I wouldn't exaggerate the extent to which people know the answer to this question. And I don't think it's a bad question at all, therefore.
I'm so relieved to hear you say that.
We have to remember that the mid-19th century is a time when in the transatlantic world, the norm is not Republican, small r, government, that is, living in a republic. The norm is still monarchies and aristocracies and societies in which non-aristocrats have relatively few rights and particularly little control over their government. So this is still an unusual, a very unusual place. Despite the existence of this horrible, oppressive system of slavery for white people, this is a remarkable outpost of freedom, and of course, especially for white men, since white women have considerably fewer rights than men. But for white men, then, this is the cutting edge of progress. They believe that what protects the rights that they have is the strength and unity of the country. And they fear that as sections of the country begin to withdraw from the union, the country will continue to fragment, that this will only be the beginning of the fracturing of the union. And by the way, there's some reason to think in retrospect that they were right. There are, for example, individuals, including the mayor in New York City, who begin to talk actively about pulling New York out of the union, because New York in that era has powerful economic ties to the slave South, and making it a so-called free city on the model of such things in Europe. Sections of the lower Midwest display sympathy for the South. Sections of Midwestern states heavily populated by white migrants out of the South. And so instead of there being one powerful, more or less powerful country in North America, south of Canada, that is, and north of Mexico, there might be two and maybe three and maybe four and so on. And that in turn might very well lead to the end of Republican government in North America. And again, we're talking about an era in which much of the world still thinks that Republican, non-monarchical, non-aristocratic government is doomed. And that had been the opinion in Europe for many, many centuries, based on looking at what had happened to ancient Greece and ancient Rome and various city-states thereafter. So the idea that republics are stable is not very widespread. And indeed, large numbers of forces in monarchical Europe are rubbing their hands in positive anticipation of seeing this dangerous, provocative idea, large republic sustaining itself, finally crumbling.
So, but how much of preserving the Union, as far as the North was concerned, was economic? Because it needed access to the South's cotton.
Well, that's a factor. Textile manufacturers in New England want that cotton and want easy access to cotton. Furthermore, farmers in the Midwest want easy and continuous access to the Mississippi River in order to sell things to Southerners and to export through the port of New Orleans. But I think it's too easy to exaggerate the degree to which economic motives are driving the North. I think more powerful a motive is the desire to preserve the Union in order to preserve Republican liberty.
Are you shocked when you still see people flying the Confederate flag, or when you see state houses flying the Confederate flag?
Well, I'm no longer shocked because I've been exposed to it for so long and been arguing against it for so long, but I'm still deeply offended by its appearance because it seems evident from history, both distant and near, that more than 9 times out of 10, those who are flying that flag are not doing it simply out of regional loyalty or some sort of misty nostalgia, but as a statement of political intent that leaves no room for genuine racial equality.
Do you think it's impossible to separate slavery and the Civil War?
I think so.
Because I know some people say, oh, no, we were fighting for a way of life. It's not about slavery. Of course, the way of life was dependent on slavery.
Just what you said. It was impossible for most people to claim to be fighting simply for a way of life, to imagine that way of life without slavery at its center. And in fact, I think it's impossible for anybody to imagine that particular way of life without slavery at its center, because that's exactly where it was.
We started this interview talking about the movie Lincoln. I just want to get back to that for a moment. One of the characters in the movie is Thaddeus Stevens, who's portrayed by Tommy Lee Jones, who's one of the radical Republicans who seeks the abolition of slavery. How does the Tommy Lee Jones portrayal compare to what you know of the actual Thaddeus Stevens?
Well, that's an interesting question. One of the aspects of the portrayal is that he, in fact, has a black mistress, his housekeeper.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, we don't really know that that's true. There were all sorts of allegations of at the time made by members of the opposition party for whom having sexual relations with a black woman proved you immoral on the face of it. So those accusations were bandied about all the time. And so
you think it
might
have been
clear.
More of an attempt to smear him than
exactly.
anything else.
Exactly, which is not how Stevens would have viewed it, because Stevens was a genuine racial egalitarian. And that part of the depiction is true. So whether or not this particular aspect of his life accorded with the cinematic version, it certainly is true that he was remarkably egalitarian in racial terms. He was the foremost fighter against slavery and for racial equality in the Congress. He was the most important single figure, I would say. It's also true, and I think undersold in the film, that Stevens and the radicals were way ahead of Lincoln throughout the war on these questions, pointed the way forward for Lincoln, and without their pressure and without their agitation and without their constant demands, it's not at all clear Lincoln would have eventually moved in the same direction. They and Stevens as an individual are in a very important part of the story of how slavery comes to an end.
Well, Bruce Levine, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for giving me the chance to be on your show.
Bruce Levine speaking with Terry Gross last Tuesday. Levine's new book is The Fall of the House of Dixie. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. This Sunday sees the premiere of the second season of Girls, the highly acclaimed sitcom starring writer-director Lena Dunham. It's one of several cable comedies returning this weekend, all of which feature very flawed, unapologetically abrasive characters. Our TV critic David Biancooley has this review.
Of all the cable comedies returning with new episodes Sunday, Girls is the most ambitious, as well as the most unpredictable and occasionally unsettling. When 30-something premiered on ABC more than 25 years ago, yes, it's been that long, that drama series was both embraced and attacked for focusing so intently on the self-obsessed problems of people in their 30s. What that drama did for that generation, Girls does for a new one, and for an even younger demographic by presenting a quartet of young women in their mid-20s. I say young women. This HBO comedy, being completely upfront with how much its characters still have to learn and grow, is titled Girls. That title is no accident, and the growing pains in this comedy sometimes are so uncomfortable to watch, they make you squirm. But Girls, without question, has the definite aroma of both honesty and originality. The four main characters, aspiring writer Hannah, art curator Marnie, free spirit Jessa, repressed spirit Shoshana, have problems holding on to jobs, maintaining their intimate relationships, and even staying close to one another. The breakups are messy, but so are the less dramatic times. Sex, in this series, usually gets down to equal parts passion and awkwardness, which makes it seem all the more real and, like the emotions displayed throughout, all the more raw. HBO sent out 4 episodes of Season 2 for preview, and a lot happens that I won't reveal here. It's important to acknowledge, though, that these young women, these girls, really are changing and growing and adapting to tough life in the big city. It's also important, I think, to note that the show addresses head-on one of the central complaints leveled against it last season, that Hannah's world was so relentlessly white. And it addresses it in such a clever way, it reveals just how smart a show Girls really is. Hannah, played by Lena Dunham, is committed to a new boyfriend, Sandy, played by Donald Glover. Sandy happens to be black, but also happens to be a Republican. And when he criticizes some of Hannah's writing in episode 2, they begin to fight, and both sides end up playing the race card.
I'm actually so happy that you didn't like it. If you just loved it, like everyone else does, that would be so simple. But this actually opens up a dialogue about my work, same kind of dialogue we've had about your political beliefs.
There's no dialogue. I know what I believe. I'm steadfast in it. I'm fine with it.
So you mean, like, even though you spend all this time with me and my gay roommate, you don't have any feeling that he should be allowed to have, like, a beautiful wedding like all the ones we saw earlier on Say Yes to the Dress?
Hannah, this is because I didn't like your essay.
It's not because you didn't like my essay. It's because we're having an open conversation about things we believe in, and I'm also a little horrified by the fact that you think people should just be allowed to own guns.
It's way more complicated than that.
Is it, though?
Yeah.
More complicated than that?
Yeah, it is.
I also would love to know how you feel about the fact that 2 out of 3 people on death row are black men.
Wow, Hannah. Well, I didn't know that. Thank you for enlightening me about how things are tougher for minorities. Thank you.
I can't tell if you're being sarcastic.
I am.
Okay, well, it's hard for me to say because I really like you, but I think our political beliefs are just too different and that we should just be friends.
I knew this. This always happens. This always happens.
What
I don't
always
even know.
Happens?
This whole, like, oh, I'm a white girl and I moved to New York and I'm having a great time. And so, oh, I got a fixed gear bike and I'm going to date a black guy. And we're going to go to a dangerous part of town. All that bullshit. Like, yeah, I know this. I've seen it happen a million times. And then they can't deal with who I am.
You know what? Honestly, maybe you should think about the fact that you could be fetishizing me. Because how many white women have you dated? Sounds like a lot from what you just said.
What?
And
really?
Maybe you think of us as just one big white blobby mass with, like, stupid ideas that you can't deal with. So why don't you lay this thing down, flip it, and reverse it? Because I don't think it's very nice.
You just said a Missy Elliott lyric. And
I don't
sure
know who that is.
Girls is the polar opposite of a cable show like The Sopranos or Breaking Bad. And not because it's a comedy and those are dramas. The dramatic scenes in Girls, and there are lots of them, are plenty intense. But Tony Soprano and Walter White would go through entire seasons without ever uttering exactly what they're thinking. While on Girls, that's just about all any of the characters do. It's unfiltered honesty on parade, but it's quite a parade. And even though I'm way past the target demographic, I still find it a fascinating parade to watch. All the other cable comedy shows returning this Sunday, coincidentally, feature characters who talk openly and a lot, and who are as abrasive as they are attractive. On HBO, Girls is followed by Enlightened, starring Laura Dern as a demoted former executive trying to bring down her corporation from within. And on Showtime, there's a trio of shows starring dysfunctional protagonists, all returning with their season premieres this weekend. On Shameless, William H. Macy plays the patriarch of a resourceful family of con artists, a family that throws him out when he returns after an extended bender. On Californication, David Duchovny plays a hedonistic writer whose family throws him into rehab. And on House of Lies, Don Cheadle plays a corporate advisor who's just the sort of scheming one percenter Laura Dern's character is targeting over on Enlightened. Individually, these majorly flawed characters may make for bold TV writing, but collectively, they're a little tiring. And as comedies go, or are supposed to go, they're not always that funny. But the fact that HBO and Showtime are going head-to-head with their best and brightest sitcoms on the same night and at the same time means both premium cable networks are taking their comedy very seriously. And their competition, too. But for me, of this entire group, the sitcom to take the most seriously is Girls. I watch and enjoy all the others, but Girls is the one that's the most surprising. And, in the long run, I suspect, will be the most memorable and influential.
David Bianculli is founder and editor of the website TV Worth Watching and teaches TV and film history at Rowan University. If you don't watch Downton Abbey, you might be tired of hearing about Lady Mary and Matthew Crawley's romantic troubles or whether Thomas and O'Brien will ever get their comeuppance. But even if you aren't a fan of the Masterpiece series, we think you'll find its creator and writer, our guest Julian Fellowes, an insightful observer of social class in 20th century England. Fellowes grew up the son of a diplomat with an aristocratic background, and he has a title himself, Lord Fellowes of West Stafford. Fellowes is an actor as well as a writer, and much of his writing has dealt with class distinctions and how they affect human relationships. His screenplay for the 2001 Robert Altman film Gosford Park won an Oscar. Downton Abbey, which has won a host of awards, focuses on an aristocratic English family and their servants in the early 20th century when sweeping changes were breaking down old social barriers. In this scene from the season 3 premiere, which aired last week, Lord Grantham, played by Hugh Bonneville, ponders his changing world with his mother-in-law, an American, played by Shirley MacLaine.
You know, the way to deal with the world today is not to ignore it. If you do, you'll just get hurt.
Sometimes I feel like a creature in the wilds whose natural habitat is gradually being destroyed.
Some animals adapt to new surroundings. It seems a better choice than extinction.
I don't think it is a choice. I think it's what's in you.
Well, let's hope that what's in you will carry you through these times to a safer shore.
Well, Julian Fellowes, Lord Fellowes, welcome to Fresh Air.
Well, it's very nice to be here.
Well, let's talk about Downton Abbey. And I wanted to play a clip from season one. This is a moment at a table in the kitchen downstairs where the servants are all having tea. And we hear one of them, Ms. O'Brien, who's played by Siobhan Finneran, disparaging Matthew Crawley. He's a cousin of the master of the house who's arrived on the scene and may inherit Downton, the whole place. We'll hear a shuffling of furniture as the servants spring to their feet because Lady Grantham, who's played by Elizabeth McGovern, has suddenly showed up in the kitchen and has overheard Miss O'Brien, her own lady's maid, talking down Matthew Crawley. She rebukes Miss O'Brien, and this leads to an interesting exchange after that among the servants. Let's listen.
I'm sorry, but I have standards.
Just saying something ever so odd.
And if anyone thinks I'm going to pull my forelock and curtsy to this Mr. Nobody from nowhere...
O'Brien. No. Were you discussing Mr. Crawley?
Yes, my lady.
Is it your place to do so?
I've got my opinions, my lady, same as anybody.
Can I help your ladyship?
This is the button we're missing from my new evening coat. I found it lying on the gravel. But I was shocked at the talk I heard as I came in. Mr. Crawley is his lordship's cousin and heir. You will, therefore, please, accord him the respect he's entitled to.
But you don't like him yourself, milady. You never wanted him to come
here. You're sailing perilously close to the wind, O'Brien. If we're to be friends, you will not speak in that way again about the Crawleys or any member of Lord Grantham's family. Now I'm going up to rest. Wake me at the dressing gong.
I don't think that's fair, not here in the servants' hall.
I agree. If she was a real lady, she wouldn't have come down here. She'd have rung for me and given me the button, that's all.
This isn't her territory. We can say what we like down here.
Who says?
The law. And Parliament. There is such a thing as free speech.
Not when I'm in charge. Don't push your luck, Thomas.
And that's from the series Downton Abbey, created and written by our guest, Julian Fellowes. It's such a lovely scene, and what we hear here is the class lines are clear, the roles are clear, and yet they're changing. The series begins, what, in 1912. This is a particular moment in class relations in Britain, isn't it?
Well, I think it was attractive to us because it was a period of tremendous change in quite a short time, you know, between 1912... When we begin the first show, and 1922, where we are at the end of season three, is only 10 years. And yet the changes in Britain were enormous between the sort of end of high imperial confidence and so on, and then through the war years and finally into the uncertainty of the 20s, when all sorts of things were being challenged. And you know, these great revolutions of women's rights or workers' rights or whatever, they don't come out of nowhere. They are there earlier and they're just below the surface, and then something like a war happens and it makes everything come through. But, you know, you don't invent from nothing. It hasn't quite come yet, but it's sort of fizzing away somewhere. And that's what a scene like that will tell you, that they're nearly at the end of always being second banana. And they can express that.
Right. And then some among them say, not so fast, remember your place.
Well, I mean, one of the interesting things about this kind of drama is that, you know, the family upstairs are on the whole all equal. They're certainly equal in terms of class and position, but, you know, they might record respect to the father or something like that, but they're not at all different socially. That's not true of the people below Stairs who are working there. There is a vast social range between Carson the butler and Daisy the kitchen maid, and all of these ranks were sort of observed, you know, and you had these, I mean, we can't do them all because heaven knows we have enough characters and locations as it is, but in a real house, you would have a special sitting room for visiting valets and a special sitting room for visiting ladies' maids and so on. On and on it went, the detail of this extraordinarily complicated structure. But, you know, that said, it was on the brink of starting to come down.
One of the things that I love about the series is that as a viewer, I gradually become aware of the distinctions among the servants and others by the forms of address. You know, the aristocrats are referred to as lord and lady, or her, your lordship or your ladyship. The servants, even those of highest rank, are referred to by their last names only by the aristocrats, even when speaking affectionately. I mean, when there's a moment when Lady Grantham is talking to Mrs. O'Brien, and they're having a nice intimate conversation, but she still calls her O'Brien. Yeah. And then among the servants, some are called Mr. and Mrs., those of lower rank, like the kitchen maid Daisy, only by their first names. There were a clear set of rules and forms of address here, huh?
Well, I mean, we live in an era where there are sort of no rules for anything anymore. But of course, the good thing about rules is you always know what you're doing. You always know what you should wear. You always know where you're supposed to be, when you're supposed to get there, what you're supposed to do when you do get there. You know, we've lost that kind of security. I think that that is one reason why, you know, the show appeals, because it seems to show a more ordered and kind of ordained world. In fact, of course, that is largely a myth. It was a world where all sorts of, as I've said, things were bubbling just beneath the surface. But nevertheless, in terms of your daily life, what you wore when you got up, what you called people, what you did next, I think it was sort of easier to follow the plot than in our own time.
The Maggie Smith character in Downton Abbey is just such a delight. Tell us who she is, how she fits into the family.
Well, she's really based on my eldest great aunt, who was quite a tough character, but she was no tougher on anyone else than she was on herself. In fact, in real life, she had quite a tragic life. Her husband died of wounds at the end of the First World War, and her only child drowned on active service in the Second. So she had a lot to bear, poor thing. But she was tough and funny. And some of the phrases that, Matt, you know, what's a weekend and stuff like that, come from her. I remember in Gosford Park, one question Maggie asked me. She said, "I don't understand about the marmalade." And I said, "Oh, well, that was this particular aunt, because Lady Trentham in Gosford is also sort of based on her." And I said, "This particular aunt always thought that if a house ran out of its own jams and jellies, then it was not being well run, and it was a sign of its weakness." "Oh," she said, I've got it. And she does that line so wonderfully when she looks into the jam pot and says, "Ooh, bought marmalade, I call that very feeble." And what I love about Maggie is that she has this extraordinary skill to bring many different aspects of a character into her delineation, but they never seem contradictory. She never turns into a different person. A lesser actor would, you know, find it difficult to be kind and cruel simultaneously, or superficial here but quite deep here. But she manages to synthesize all these elements into a believable woman.
Well, we should hear one of these moments, and this is from the first season, where she and Lady Grantham, played again by Elizabeth McGovern, are sitting and discussing the difficult matter of finding a suitable husband for Lady Mary, the oldest of the Crawley daughters.
"How about some house parties?"
"She's been asked to one next month by Lady Anne McNair."
"That's a terrible idea. She doesn't know anyone under 100.
"I might send her over to visit my aunt. She could get to know New York."
"Oh, I don't think things are quite that desperate. Poor Mary. She's been terribly down in the mouth lately."
"She was very upset by the death of poor Mr. Pamook."
"Why?" "Oh, she didn't know him. One can't go to pieces at the death of every foreigner. We'd all be in a state of collapse whenever we opened a newspaper."
Can't get enough of Maggie Smith. That's her and Elizabeth McGovern in Downton Abbey, created and written by our guest, Julian Fellowes. Dinners are really something at the Crawleys. Lord Grantham dresses basically like an orchestra conductor. Was this done every night? I mean, didn't they ever want to just dress down and eat leftover turkey sandwiches?
It was pretty well done every night. I mean, there's a wonderful quote when Duff Cooper asked his brother-in-law, the Duke of Rutland. He said, when black tie was just beginning to come in the 20s, but still white tie was normal in the sort of great houses. And he said to the Duke, "Don't you ever wear black tie?" And the Duke thought for a moment and said, "When I'm dining alone with the Duchess in her bedroom." And, you know, that was his idea of letting it all hang out. But no, I mean, they were a formal people. Those were the correct clothes for eating dinner. And one of the difficulties when we wear those costumes is that most of us are dressing on our own. So we're in a wrestling match with studs and pins of this and that and links and so on. Whereas there, you were always being helped with it, as you would be in a film or a television. And that makes it different. I mean, in the 50s, Dior very much revived the sort of corseted, almost crinoline dress and so on. But it didn't last very long because it wasn't suited for getting into on your own.
In season three, an American arrives on the scene, a real American here. I mean, Cora, Lady Grantham, is an American, but who has spent a long time in England as the wife of Lord Grantham. But her mother, who's played by Shirley MacLaine, arrives. Tell us a little bit about her and the role that she plays.
Well, what I really wanted the audience to be reminded of, really, by Martha Levinson, played by Shirley MacLaine, is that Cora is not some ancient American aristocrat. She's not a Winthrop, you know, or a Stuyvesant, or one of those founding father families. She is the product of new money, quite a lot of it, but that's who she is. But there were others, like Mary Leiter, who married Lord Curzon, who came from men who had made their own fortunes. And that is what Cora's come from. And the reason I want the audience to be sort of aware of that is Cora's story is really that she married into the system and swallowed it wholesale and got it all down. But now that the world is changing and things are being challenged, in a funny way, her original values are much more suited to the modern world than Robert's. You know, she has the American work ethic. She is not obsessed by rank. She is kind of much more free about accepting the changes that are coming, as you will be seeing in the third series. The future doesn't frighten her. And so we have that kind of exemplified by Martha, because we've got the two grandmothers now, Violet, played by Maggie Smith, and Martha, played by Shirley MacLaine. But they're totally different. Violet is nostalgic for the past. She thinks everything was better in 1870. Her clothes reflect this, her manners and so on. Whereas Martha believes in the modern world. She likes the way it's going. She wants to wear modern clothes and modern makeup and fly in a plane and just get on with the future. So, you know, you've got, I hope, an interesting clash there of beliefs and philosophies.
You know, I thought we would hear just a moment of their interaction. This is Maggie Smith and Shirley MacLaine, the two grandmothers, in a moment from season three.
Oh, dear. I'm afraid the war has made old women of us both.
Oh, I wouldn't say that. But then I always keep out of the sun. Yeah, how'd you find Downton on your return?
Much the same, really. Probably too much the same. But then I don't want to cast a pall over all the happiness.
How could you ever do that?
Tell me, what do you think of young Lochinvar, who has so ably carried off our granddaughter and our money? Oh, do you approve of him?
Not as much as you will, when you get to know him.
Has he gone home to change?
Oh, no, we won't see him again tonight. The groom never sees the bride the night before the wedding.
Nothing ever alters for you people, does it? Revolutions erupt and monarchies crash to the ground, and the groom still cannot see the bride before the wedding.
You Americans never understand the importance of tradition.
Yes, we do. We just don't give it power over us. History and tradition took Europe into a world war. Maybe you should think about letting go of its hand.
That's from season 3 of Downton Abbey, written and created by our guest Julian Fellowes. Season 3 is now on Masterpiece on PBS. Of course, one of the changes that comes to the Crawley family, the shocking development of one of the daughters, Lady Sybil, marrying the family chauffeur, Tom Branson. I don't know how likely this would have been to happen in 1912 or 14 or 15, but one of the things I love about the way it's portrayed here is that, of course, the aristocracy is shocked and they have to come to terms with it. Some react differently. But then the chauffeur goes back to the house where he was a part of the service and has to interact with the other servants who are so used to clear social distinctions, and he has changed.
I mean, I always like to base these things on a real story. And when people say, oh, that would never have happened, of course it did happen, just as love affairs between servants and members of the family happened. They were very disapproved, though, but they still happened. And this particular story is based on the daughter of an earl who ran off with the groom, actually. It wasn't the chauffeur, it was the groom, but I don't think there's a great distinction in that. And they had to put up with it. I think it was very difficult, and of course they rather encouraged the couple to live in Dublin because it's sort of easier if they're out of sight. But, you know, families then, like families now, when your children marry someone you would not have chosen for them, there is a moment where you have to decide, am I going to quarrel with my son or my daughter and literally no longer have them in my life? Or am I going to find a way to get on with this person? And I think most of us hope for the second. And that's really what the Granthams have to do.
Well, Julian Fellowes, thanks so much for spending some time with us.
No, I'm delighted. It was nice of you to ask me.
Julian Fellowes is the creator and writer of Downton Abbey. Its third season has just begun here in the U.S. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Nell Beschenstein is our associate producer for online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.